archetypes for yourself and make life just a heck of a lot easier, he says. Again, this is a guideline and one way to think about segmenting, but it's not the gospel. Your system needs to work for you, but key insights are to ensure the data are easily accessible by you on any device, instantly searchable, and highly organized in such a way that you can readily use your shorthand searches and codes to get what you need. Time management. Beyond being amazingly organized, Roderick is an excellent time manager. But the best connectors are. They make time to help other people. They are more than happy to do so. But they also take time out for themselves. When you become a connector at big league levels, more people are going to be clamoring for your attention. You don't want to be rude, of course, but you also don't want to spend time on people who don't have a formulated ask or who you might think are less than awesome. Adam Grant has thought long and hard about this. To him, being a connector requires being thoughtful about who you help, how you help, and when you help. What we see with failed givers is that they try to help all the people all the time with all the requests, and they end up sacrificing their own success as they devote so much time and energy to helping others that they fall behind on their own work, says Grant. They get exploited by more selfish takers, and they end up contributing in ways that are actually not all that effective. Successful givers, however, recognize their limitations. They know that they cannot help everyone equally. It's about being, yes, selective in whom you help and how much you help them. It's about blocking time on your calendar to get your own work done and saying, look, you know, I have windows where I need to progress toward my own goals, says Grant. Yes, I will set aside time to be helpful to others, but I'm going to try to manage that so that I haven't given away my entire calendar, you know, for ad hoc requests. Derek Coburn has more than 25 email templates saying no to different requests. He's not being a jerk. He wants to be helpful, but he wants to make sure he is the right guy for the job. I don't have time at all to meet or talk with anybody unless I know why we're going to be talking and if I can add value for them and or vice versa. Before I had these templates, I would get emails like, hey, can you be a guest on my podcast? Can you write a guest blog for my website? Can I pick your brain? Sometimes, especially if I knew who the person was, I never looked forward to typing that email. It was like, okay, what do I want to say? How can I be nice about it? So, a handful of the templates will say, thanks for reaching out. I'm currently focused on a few key priorities right now and more than likely don't have the time to allocate. In the event I may still be able to be helpful, can you let me know if there's anything in particular you were looking to discuss or wanted my feedback on? Nearly 75% of the time, he doesn't even get a response. Those people don't even know what they want. They just have enough free time on their hands that they want to meet people, he says. I know I'm responding in a way that is true to who I want to be and with a reply that is consistent with how I want to reply. We often joke that the most important people in our professional lives are Stephanie and Kiri, our priceless assistants, who know more about our whereabouts on a day-to-day basis than our families do. They know when we are free to talk and when we are not. We both have certain days or times when we are simply not available. They both know how to schedule meetings for us in every type of circumstance. They know the cafes we go to, so we don't have to travel across town to meet someone. How long should a coffee take? 30 minutes? An hour? We both have our own preferences. For example, Scott limits most calls to 15 minutes. If it can't be completed in 15 minutes, then we should be meeting in person, he says. Even more important, our assistants know when to make an exception to our rule. They're trained to know that if someone is a big name or CEO or influencer, then we are more than happy to go on their turf. If this is a person we have been trying to meet, then damn, we will travel anywhere to accomplish this goal. Jason Dorsey, the president of the Center for Generational Kinetics, a millennial and Gen Z research, speaking, and consulting firm, also meets people where they want. Invariably, there are generational differences. To some generations, it might mean, let's meet for coffee. For others, it might mean, let's set up a phone call or Skype call or Google Hangout, he says. The trick for those who want to build meaningful relationships is to see your own biases or patterns for how you are used to making new friends and be open to changing those patterns to meet new people. In other words, if you prefer LinkedIn or going to a social mixer or attending a conference with executives, that's your bias. Once you're aware of it, you can intentionally choose to mix it up so you meet new people in new places. It's to your benefit to adapt to people's preferences. People who adapt to the person they want to engage with are often more successful in getting meetings and building new relationships because it's less stressful for the person you want to meet, he says. Every relationship takes on its own dynamic once it's begun. But the more difficult you make it for the person in the beginning, then the harder it's going to be to have a chance to build a relationship with them long term. Dorsey acknowledges that this can initially be uncomfortable for people of any generation who are conditioned to engage with others in a certain way. For example, by text or Snapchat. But those who are flexible are the ones who create the greatest likelihood to build diverse friendships that open doors and make the world more meaningful. Setting up and maintaining formalized groups. Just as you've set up a framework for how to segment your networks, you also need a framework for how you will manage and create formalized groups or experiences. First, you need to determine the group's bylaws. Are you going to have written rules that are clearly stated, or are there more amorphous situations where the rules are simply implied? Are you running a Facebook forum with specific rules to participate, like Sloan's List? Is it a dinner with a referral-only policy on attendees, like Jonathan Levy's dinners? Or is it more of a member community, like YEC, that has guidelines and policies for both events and online discussions? Clear-cut clarity and rules. You must clearly spell out what the rules are in your organization. With some groups, say Summit, members are not allowed to post anything on social media when they are attending certain events or in particular locations during Summit experiences. In YEC, we have an informal, no asshole rule in place. Well, actually it is formal. We just don't put it in writing. We're joking. Kinda. But you have to think about these things. Obviously, the word asshole is subjective. One person's asshole is another person's savior. We think of it like porn. You know it when you see it. In the superconnector world, assholes are pretty easy to identify. They are usually those folks who are clearly out for themselves. You know whom we're talking about. The sorts of people who take, who are the opposite of team players. The sorts of people who are quick to ask you for help, but reluctant to reciprocate in kind. You know, assholes. The good news is that assholes don't have a long shelf life. The even better news is that we have been successful at policing our community precisely because we don't have to police it. Community members tell us what the line is. That is, you're an asshole. If you have a solid group there for the right spirit and intention and multiple people are saying this crosses the line, then take note. It crosses the line. Having said that, the best communities are those that make rules and follow them. You have to enforce rules and be clear. What are the rules of engagement? What do you want your community to stand for publicly? When people talk about your network, what do you want them to say? For example, when they talk about YEC, they usually say that we are the most influential youth entrepreneurship organization in the country. We like this. In most groups we create with our partners through the community company, we disapprove of anything overly promotional in nature. That could mean blog posts members have written, deals or discounts their companies are offering, links to donate to a charity they're supporting, and so forth. It's not that we think these things aren't necessarily valuable in the right environment. They're just not right for our groups, which people join to get away from the noise that makes their social media experience less valuable. We shy away from anything that can cause members to get vicious with one another. Politics is a no-no in the community company groups. So is talking smack on vendors. If you had a bad experience with a vendor, our groups are not the place to vent. Why? Because in the well-connected communities of people we curate, someone inevitably knows someone at said company, or actually might work there themselves, which can lead to a not-so-exceptional experience. And, keep in mind, we used the phrase talking smack and not asking for help. Often, members come to our support groups with an issue with a vendor. Someone has a connection there, and problems get solved. Obviously, it's not always easy to be black and white. There will often be a couple of gray areas that can't be avoided, and that's okay. Enforcing the rules. How do you make sure people follow rules? Making them known from day one is a good jumping-off point. One way to do this would be to send a personal welcome message to your newest group members the minute they join. Be very clear about what the rules are. At the community company, we send new members a detailed document with all the guidelines. Inevitably, people will break the rules anyway, and you'll have to step in and remind them what they're doing doesn't fly. But if you set up the ground rules early, they won't be able to say, "Oh, I didn't know," and you'll have more of a case for deleting their posts than if you didn't properly communicate from the get-go. Sloan's List has rules that members must adhere to, but while they are seriously enforced, they're nothing too elaborate. It's mostly about remaining consistent and having protocols in place to keep everything above board when things go astray. When Ryan Matzner and Courtney Boyd Myers were creating Sloan's List, they initially chose to let people in who were part of the small to medium-sized circles around them. It was people who we knew would get it and would post the right jobs and not post the wrong ones, says Matzner. And then we gave everyone in the network the power to invite people in their network. And each invitation is then queued up for approval, and each post also. It is moderated, but lightly. Each post must be written in a uniform style, including the title. If someone tries to post something that doesn't conform with that, we'll actually reject their post and message them with a note explaining what the norms and expectations are, he says. If they try to post again in violation, Matzner or Myers will consider kicking them out of the group altogether. Recruiters are kicked out. So are inappropriate job listings, like an unpaid foreign opportunity. We just look to the person to make sure it's a legit account, he says. If we see anyone misbehaving, we remove them from the group. About one person a month is removed, on average. We know. It's difficult to tell someone no or to kick them off a list. And as community builders, we naturally want to make our people happy. But don't be afraid to be a stickler for the rules in groups you create. Think about the greater good. Most groups fail to become truly valuable to the people in them because nobody is steering the ship. It's up to you to put on the captain's hat and keep things in shipshape order. Picking a platform. People shine in different areas. Some people are really great one-on-one. Others are better digitally. Still others know how to work the room and are great at a dinner party. The point is, figure out which area best showcases your strengths and then work within that. That should be your main platform, where you shine. Which doesn't mean you don't want to use other platforms. It just means that as a leader, you should always begin in the area you are most comfortable. Schedule engagements to maintain communication so the group takes on a life of its own. Let's say you're doing a Facebook forum. You know that on every Thursday, you want to make sure that you're checking in with the community. If you are looking for staff, post your staff needs on Thursdays. Thursday is your day. Why do this? because you are building a system wherein you know you'll do the same ask or post in a forum, so it builds legacy and history. The community can then take on a life of its own beyond you. Chapter 15. Google-proofing your reputation. Whenever you're introduced to new people, or reach out to meet new people, the first thing they'll do is type your name into Google, which means that potential relationships can be made or broken based on the first page of a Google search. Think about that. You can be someone who has robust search findings filled with strong content, press, and relevant social media postings, or it can be bare. Or worse, in select cases, it can have negative results based on past indiscretions or untruths. The point is, we aren't saying you should use black hat SEO, shady, frowned-upon strategies, tactics to scrub the web. But we are saying that if you're going to put a lot of time into building and nurturing relationships, it is probably best to make sure that your best digital footprint is put forward. In short, the 5-second Google search smell check that people will do on you matters. A lot. Second, not only is it important to manage your reputation, but the content people find about you has the opportunity to produce a warmer, friendlier first impression or interaction. What's written about you in the press or by bloggers, what you share or what you publish, paints a picture about who you are and what you stand for. It amplifies your thesis. The right context about you can help people you seek to meet or know better get a sense of you quickly, leading to greater results in your initial encounters. It can also make people more interested in meeting you faster. In a busy world, having no digital footprint, or a poor one, doesn't necessarily scream priority to others. The reverse, however, has the chance to make a whole different kind of first impression, one that can make your actual in-person first impression far better and more fulfilling. Reputation matters. Everything you say, everything you do, everything you tweet or like or post broadcasts a piece of yourself. Whether you like it or not, other people will judge that piece very harshly. The digital world is unforgiving. If you don't believe us, just ask any of the people mentioned in John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is about people whose lives were pretty much ruined because of one erroneous tweet, or a badly titled Instagram photo, or a poorly timed joke. You could also talk to our good friend Pete Kissler, who has personal experience with this on a few different levels. Kissler is the co-founder of Brand Yourself, a reputation management company. He built his company out of necessity. During his senior year at Syracuse University, he did what most college kids do and began applying for jobs. He was a good student and figured he'd get at least some interest. But that's not what happened. No one bit. He didn't understand why, so he took to the web to do some sleuthing. That's when he discovered that there was another Pete Kissler dominating search engine results. But this Pete Kissler wasn't an earnest young student seeking an entry-level position. He was a criminal. When employers Googled Pete Kissler, they didn't stumble upon an impressive soon-to-be college grad ready to dominate the business world, but found a guy with an entirely different rap sheet. Not that any of the companies knew the difference. As far as they were concerned, there was one Pete Kissler, and they didn't want him anywhere near their company, not even sweeping floors. The experience was unnerving, to say the least, but it inspired good Pete Kissler to do two things: to try to fix his reputation, and to launch Brand Yourself with his friend Patrick Ambron. Everything we do is now recorded online forever, which means we need more tools to make sure this doesn't harm us, says Ambron. We now have the technology to track and store all that activity. That means everything we post on Facebook or Twitter, and every item we search for, website we visit, online transaction we make, and conversation we have through text or messenger exists somewhere. A Facebook status update you made years ago may eventually get you fired. Even more scary, a private email or message you sent to a friend, even if you deleted it, could come back and bite you. What this translates to is pretty basic. If your online reputation is a disaster, you most likely won't get the gig, or the meeting, or the opportunity. Sad to say, but we are all, each one of us, one bad Google search result away from losing someone's trust. Still don't believe us? Check out these stats, courtesy of Brand Yourself. 82% of business decision makers said that presence in search results was an influential factor when vetting people online. 42% of the online U.S. adults who looked somebody up in a search engine looked someone up before deciding to do business with them. 27% have searched for someone they met in a professional setting, such as a networking event. 23% of online U.S. adults who have searched someone online have looked up a coworker. If you're not mindful of the way the world perceives you online, then you're leaving a lot to chance. And what have we learned about superconnectors? That they do not leave anything to chance or happenstance or any other ant's word. If you don't control what people see about you online, someone else will. Which means that you must be in charge of your own story. Because what it boils down to is what people see when they Google your name. And you want it to be positive. Good versus bad context. If you've been in business during this epoch, chances are you've been on the receiving end of a bad Google result. We have, and we'd be lying if we didn't admit that it hurt our business and personal relationships, not to mention our self-esteem. No one wants to discover that their reputation has taken a huge wallop. But there are right ways and wrong ways of handling less than awesome information about yourself. A few years ago, for example, a Reddit thread popped up in which a prospective YEC member asked if any other Redditors saw value in our organization. Several people chimed in with scathing reviews, using phrases that included the lovely statement, "money down the drain." Ouch. It was frustrating and painful, especially because on Reddit, anonymity is a norm. We didn't even have a way to validate if the people leaving the biting remarks were actual past or current members. We were pretty confident they were internet trolls, but still, you never know. So what's a person to do? We could have easily gotten defensive, but that would have just given credence to the commenters. We could have ignored them altogether, but that would have made it seem like we didn't care, which we did. A lot. We knew that these types of posts tend to rank high in search results. If untreated, there's always the potential for unwanted vitality. Instead, we found a middle ground, and Ryan responded to each negative commenter with something like this. "Sorry to hear about your experience so far as a member. I can't find a George Clooney in our YEC database. I assume this is an alias. Would love to connect over email and see what we can do to make your experience everything that it should be. Email me anytime at, and we will figure it out." Ryan's goal was to acknowledge the person's negative experience while also pointing out, in a friendly way, that he couldn't validate that he was an actual member. It also showed others who saw the thread that we cared so deeply about customer support that an actual company head was reaching out. No one was expecting a decent human response from one of the higher-ups. Nor did they think anyone was really going to try to listen. But Ryan did. You'll also notice that nowhere in Ryan's response did he act defensively. That would have just exacerbated the situation and opened the door for more scrutiny, says Ryan. People don't like to be called out on being wrong, especially when they are, and especially online anonymously, where there are very few consequences. Ryan ended his comment with a general message for anyone who happened to Google YEC and found this Reddit thread. "I'm one of the co-founders of YEC. Happy to speak to anyone who is interested in membership and has questions. You can email me directly at, I'll be honest about whether I think YEC would be valuable to you and your business." To this day, the few minutes he spent writing a response put him in contact with prospective YEC members at least a couple of times per month and have led to tens of thousands of dollars in new business. Instead of getting worked up over bad reviews or bad context, you should use them as an opportunity to show what you really stand for. Take the conversation elsewhere and own the opportunity to paint a more accurate picture. Bad context. Ryan's response was a strong example of adding good context in response to bad context. Bad context after bad context would be when, say, you get into a Twitter war with a random person you have never met. Twitter, as we all know, is highly traceable. It lives forever. Even if you erase it, there can still be trails. Once something's out there, it's out there forever. You don't want this, especially if your responses aren't examples of your most shining moments. Scott is the go-to guy on this subject. He has been told that when he gets mad, he can be a little, scary. In 2012, we started the hashtag Fix Young America movement, something that we were especially proud of. Hashtag Fix Young America was an initiative and book whose goal was, in short, to inspire young people and leaders to work together to spark an entrepreneurial revolution, as we called it. After a story about it was published in the New York Times, Salon wrote a follow-up, a screed, frankly, against Scott and YEC. It was a brutal, one-sided piece. But instead of taking Ryan's approach, Scott went full-on bull in a china shop in the comments section. He attacked the journalist and the article, as well as the commenters who were commenting on his comments. "I was so heated, Ryan literally had to call me to tell me to stop writing," says Scott. "Looking back, I was incredibly foolish. I looked immature and petty, and my actions caused many reactions that only made the situation worse. I both created and caused bad context, all because I handled the situation incredibly poorly." Bad context begets more bad context when you let it. But he learned a lesson. "Never do anything to give the wrong impression about who you are," he says. "Sometimes the best reputation management is about what people say you aren't versus what they say you are." You are constantly building a narrative that people believe in, buy into, and convey to others on your behalf. Your reputation shouldn't be forced or crafted via marketing messages. Rather, it should be natural, simple, and compelling. Said another way, it displays the best you because it is the real you. Reputation is something much more core. It's who you are in the eyes of others, says Adam Grant. And what matters there, ultimately, is not visibility or prominence or positivity, but sincerity. What does successful reputation management look like? The more context-rich information you put out about yourself and your thesis, the better information you're supplying other people. This will help them get to know who you are and what you stand for before you meet them, which is likely to make for a better encounter. Likewise, it might also help others opt themselves out of meeting with you, as they don't necessarily see alignment. Since time is such a commodity, it's best to know these things up front so as not to waste precious minutes doing things you don't want to do. There are things that can pop up that really hurt your career, says Patrick Ambron of Brand Yourself. On the other end, the better you look online, the more of an edge you get, whether you like it or not. It's not always the best person who gets the job. It's the best person who's also good at promoting themselves because we look so much online. And on both of those ends, if you think about it, and we can do so case by case, on the risky end, it's important to know that no matter how responsible you are, something bad can happen to you online. According to Ambron, research shows that if you have 4 or 5 highly visible things out, your opportunities increase like crazy. On the other end, one bad thing can really put your career off the rails. So what should you be doing to manage your reputation? Other than the obvious, that would be not posting stupid stuff, You want to be proactive. Even if you think you've got nothing to hide or you're very responsible, says Ambron, because a bad thing can happen to anybody and hurt their career. Also, he points out, anyone can say anything about you on the web, and it doesn't matter whether it's true. Since you want to be vigilant about what's out there about you, you've got to do a little self-Googling every so often. Just as bad things happen to good people, bad internet happens to good people. Rather than running the risk of waking up one day, logging on, discovering that the world thinks O.J. Simpson has a better reputation than you do, and then freaking out, you should take action before it reaches that point. To start, you want to do an audit of what's already out there about you. A lot of people have risk factors that they don't even realize, so Google yourself and then go through your social media accounts and try to delete things that raise flags, says Ambron. What are those flag raisers? Oh, you know, shots of you doing shots, or trekking naked through the streets of Manhattan, or using bigoted or sexist language. A lot of people don't realize, you know, if they're making jokes to their friend's wall or something, it's available to everybody, he says. After taking stock of what's out there, you can determine a course of action. If it's something negative, delete it. If deleting it is not an option, you want to make sure there's positive content out there to replace the unwanted information. Dedicating an hour or two a month to the handful of properties you've decided to be on can, as long as you're organized, really have a giant impact, says Ambron. As long as you don't have some abnormally complicated situation, just spending 2 hours every single month can go a long way. When Kistler and Ambron were trying to overhaul Kistler's web presence, they chose 10 to 15 platforms that they thought would be good for him, including a personal website, PeteKistler.com, Twitter, Quora, LinkedIn, and SlideShare. Medium.com is another great platform that ranks well in Google if you publish a few strong posts. As a musician, he also built out his SoundCloud and YouTube, which rank very well if you publish a few songs or videos. Kistler offered to guest blog pro bono about one of his passions, personal branding, for two websites that already had excellent Google rankings, the official blog of the Syracuse University iSchool and the personal branding blog. By writing thoughtful content and publishing it on well-established platforms, I benefited from the authority their domain names had already established in search engines. By linking from them to a few of my top newly created profiles, I funneled some extra relevance into those new profiles. My guest blogger profiles on those sites also ranked well by themselves, which was great, because people could quickly find my articles and see that I was actively writing useful content about my field. Then they filled those out with positive information about him, making sure to list projects he worked on, along with information, photos, and videos. You want to make sure that stuff is rich with content, so Google knows it's really a kind of rich source of information about the topic at hand. In this case, Pete's name, Ambron says. After that, spend a few hours each month keeping them up to date by blogging, tweeting, and making presentations. In Kistler's case, that was enough to really start to own those results. But beware. Many people decide that they have to be super active on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and so they blog on a daily basis. They start producing rather shoddy posts, and guess what? Their reputation takes a major hit. Or worse, they start out strong and then burn themselves out overdoing it and eventually stop altogether. You see, people kind of think they have to be everywhere, says Ambron, and sometimes it gets in their way. How to build your personal website. Forgive us if we sound like your mother, but we want you to spend your money wisely. Ryan recently mentored a young entrepreneur who spent $2,000 to build a website, just to build his brand. It wasn't his fault. He truly knew nothing about tech. He didn't know that launching a website was so incredibly simple these days that your grandmother could do it. Instead, he got taken advantage of by a development agency that sold him on stuff he didn't need, at least in these early stages of his business. This is a good example of how having a great, diverse community of people in your corner would have been valuable. Had he met Ryan earlier, Ryan would have steered him clear of this idea. With all due respect, that was not smart, which Ryan, gently, counseled him. Ryan recently rebuilt his website in preparation for this book for a total of $46. He found a WordPress, one of the most popular platforms out there for website producers, theme on themeforest.com, whipped out his credit card, and within minutes had a new design that was 99% ready to go. Only thing left to do was install it, which the producer of the theme gladly helped him do at no additional charge. Spending $2,000 is throwing money down the drain. But the young entrepreneur cared more about the look and feel of his site than what he was saying and the content and context he was sharing. He wasted a ton of time and money building a picture-perfect website rather than getting out there, building his community, nurturing relationships, and growing his business. This is a mistake many people make when they start building a website, whether for business or for personal branding purposes. And this critical error often leads to a failure to launch moment. Here's what's most critical when you build your personal website. The content. What does it say about you? Is it honest about who you are? And does it quickly tell the website visitor what you want them to know? Aesthetics. Does it look nice? Do you have a photo of yourself that's somewhat professional, or at least is aligned with who you are? For example, you won't see a suit and tie corporate-y photo of Ryan on RyanPaw.com. He's sitting at a restaurant, wearing a beanie, and drinking a delicious stout with a foam mustache across his lip. But that's who he is, and in his world, he can get away with that. You? Maybe. Maybe not. Connection point. Is it clear how and why people should connect with you? If your website doesn't do something to connect you with people and the opportunities that come along with them, then you're missing something. This is commonly referred to as a call to action, and it should be one of the most prominent graphics on your website. Eyeballs should be drawn to it like thumbs to an iPhone. Social proof. We'll get into this much deeper in a moment, but social proof is the evidence that shows people are who they say they are, and that they're the sort of person you want to do business with. On Scott's website, scottdgerber.com, he lists all of his press to make sure people instantly see his credibility and can read about what he does from validated sources, and not just his family, or Ryan. But you don't need to be a media mogul to show social proof. Ryan, for example, isn't nearly as involved in the media landscape as Scott is. He fills in the gaps with thoughtful testimonials from colleagues he has worked with throughout the years. And in some ways, this is a strategy more aligned with who Ryan is anyway. What real people say matters more to the community-building nature of his work. From there, think about the additional content you can create to make your website more appealing to the Google gods. As Ambron noted earlier, search engines scour the web for sites with regularly updated content. For example, a blog. If you can manage one and keep a regular schedule of at least once per month, a blog is a great way to give your website the ongoing pulse it needs to rank in search results. Additional pages. Adding depth to your site helps too. A standard about page is good, but we've seen people take it a step further and develop fun facts about themselves, or build a really powerful, resource-driven page chock full of info about a topic that the person wants to rank high for. Search engine optimization, or the crazy dark art of ranking in Google, sounds scary, but there are a lot of basics you can implement that are good enough for 99.9% of the population. If you use WordPress, you can even download a plugin like the all-in-one SEO that does most of the work for you. Chapter 16. Are you a creator or a curator? Connectors aim to be known not by everyone in the universe, but rather by the right crowd of individuals who will share their goals and value systems. The right community. Everyone should create some form of real estate to call their own. It doesn't matter if it's based on original or curated content. The bigger issue is the type of medium you use. Which one is right for your audience? Writing? Podcasting? Video? Infographics? Sketch notes? Gary Vaynerchuk, a best-selling author, angel investor, and the CEO of VaynerMedia, believes that people should always decide what type of content would best fit their skill sets. If you are better verbally than on paper, then you might want to think about a podcast. If you are an expert doodler, then maybe you want to draw your message and post your big ideas on more visual platforms like Instagram or Pinterest. However, remember that the content you are providing is for your audience, not yourself. If you are known for your amazing webcasts, continue them. Vaynerchuk also believes that business owners should tailor their content to the platform it's published on. But you also need to know which type of person you are. Do you gather and share the best content for your network? Or do you see yourself as a creator of such high-value content? Both curators and creators are important. A curator makes the world less noisy and provides a valuable service by shepherding the cream to the top. But you need to be excellent at it to keep people engaged. Creators have the ability to bring new ideas or thinking and create a lot of value. But similarly, if you aren't great at it, you just end up making more noise. We recommend people pick a medium to create content as it leaves a record. An artifact, in earlier book parlance, if you will. Some of the newsletters that Adam Grant subscribes to are written by people who don't say a single thing themselves, but have a really good case around topics that he is curious to learn more about. I value their judgment about what I should be reading, what I should be watching, whom I should be listening to, he says. It's meta-sharing, helping to guide people about what else to pay attention to and what to consume that's worthwhile. One thought-provoking article that provides real, tactical, actionable advice to someone in need can give years of steady support for you and your business. It makes you a thought leader and someone worth doing business with. People wander around believing that if they only meet more brilliant, amazing, important people, their work will improve, says Grant. And the reality is that it's hard to engage with those people and learn from them unless you put something interesting and meaningful out into the world to begin with. That's what attracts their attention. When people say, it's not what you know, it's who you know, I would say, actually, who you know is often a function of what you know, and even further, what you share. How to build social proof. It's no secret that word of mouth, and word of web, is a business person's best friend. Just look at all the options we have to review products. Want to book a hotel? Just see what people are saying on TripAdvisor. Looking for a good doctor? Check out Health Grades, and so on. They are testimonials, and they help people make informed decisions. We go to these websites because we want to hear what other customers have to say. We want their recommendations on where to go, and more important, where not to go. Businesses are well aware of this. It's why they sometimes offer incentives for you to post something nice about them. But people need social proof, too. Without it, life becomes much more difficult, especially if you are trying to advance your career. At its core, social proof is the stuff on the web that validates you. Not just how you use logos on your site or email signature. That's a benefit of social proof, but not the social proof itself. The social proof is that there are independent, verifiable things in the world about you that you didn't game or pay for. Your ability to showcase and package them is very important, but only after you've earned the accreditations in the first place. When Jared Kleinert sent a cold email to Keith Ferrazzi, he already had some pretty good credentials. There was his soon-to-be-published book, $2 billion under 20, from St. Martin's. There was the TEDx talk he had given from his research. And he had great results from his work with a couple of VC-backed startups. His initial email to Ferrazzi showed the social proof of being a TEDx speaker and being an author to be, he says. That, I think, cuts out from the rest of the pack. It separates me from the noise that is his inbox. Working with Ferrazzi gave him only more credibility. He gave me his testimonial and support initially, he says. I was able to craft a case study off the work I had done for him. Social proof comes in a variety of forms. Either you write for a noteworthy outlet, they write about you, you receive an accolade or award, or someone of note writes about you. Whatever you do, do not try to fake social proof. It will backfire and cause problems for you. Nor should you use bad or underwhelming social proof. Some people are so hungry to get a logo or something on their site to validate them, they will literally use sites they've been featured on that are simply not known or unimpressive. This has the reverse effect. Better to take the proper time to get the right success under you, and then seek out the things that will truly represent you best. Social proof works both ways, and you don't want the negative version. People should build real competence and build a great reputation behind their personal brand before they go for having a personal brand that is also well known, says Kleinert. You should establish a great body of work that is impressive in your industry before you necessarily go for having a ton of people know about you. If it happens in unison, awesome. Pitching yourself as a contributor. We have worked with countless professionals who saw the content marketing space as a provocative way to grow their business, but their expectations of how it works were all wrong. Most people think that by getting published in a name-recognizable media outlet, traffic will automatically flock to your website and people will take interest in whatever value you have to provide. Nope. In fact, most pieces of content create little to no traffic to your site, leaving anyone who came in with this expectation convinced that creating content is a complete waste of time. This isn't true, but we understand the frustration. When you pitch media, you have no say over the end product. You don't control the journalist's angle, nor do you know how they'll personally feel about your expertise or what you have to say. However, being a contributor enables you to voice your thoughts in your words, so long as the editor you work with finds it noteworthy and not advertorial, that is. Scott built his entire early career pitching media outlets or blogs and writing highly valuable content on topics of interest to him. His thesis, youth entrepreneurship. This content then led journalists and television networks to reach out to him based on what he'd written and his stated expertise. By putting his own thoughts and words out there, he was able to specifically convey his points. Simultaneously, as his content became refined, his access to even better blogs and media outlets increased dramatically. His consistency and point of view helped open many doors. This then led to strong social proof. For example, as seen on XYZ, or read my column on XYZ, and thousands of articles being written about YEC over the years. People often try to pitch the press too early, and it falls on deaf ears. Journalists want to interview subjects with strong credentials and newsworthy stories. By starting on your own platform and then expanding into being a contributor, you begin to build a public track record and narrative. You become accredited by others, which leads to more prestigious organizations taking note. And so on, and so on. Pitching to be a contributor isn't easy. But today, with the ever-shifting media landscape, it certainly isn't impossible. As media outlets look for new ways to monetize their business model, they're trying to find ways to increase their page views and ad revenue with less staff. This has led to a natural increase in contributors being utilized to deliver highly relevant, valuable content. Once you have some pieces written, or a podcast or a video or whatever your preference of media platform, it's best to research the right editors at publications that have contributor programs and reach out. Don't necessarily start with the absolute top outlets in the world, but work your way up. Make sure to demonstrate why your voice and perspective are different and why they will resonate based on what's happening in the world. Scott started pitching to be a contributor before it was a thing. He didn't have any journalism background or special access. Yet within 2 years of consistency and relationship development, he ended up contributing to dozens of media outlets, ranging from CNN to the Wall Street Journal to Forbes. Not only will you end up with valuable bylines where you have more control over the final content, but media platforms are some of the highest ranking sites for SEO on the web. Most media sites will be at the top of Google, offering you strong visibility, social proof, and great content to share. One of our most coveted pieces is a blog post Scott wrote for the Huffington Post about why professional organizations are the next big frontier for publishers. That piece was read by many prospective partners of ours during the courting process. While the content didn't receive tens of thousands of views, the few hundred it did get came from a very high concentration of the exact people we wanted to meet and know. Plus, when potential partners were vetting us, they could find this article credited to Scott's name. Before he even walked in the door, he had helped to define his belief system, what he cares about, what he does, and more. This made the initial interaction warmer and friendlier. Pitching contributors rather than staff writers. If you recall, Jared Kleinert was featured in a September 6, 2015 article in USA Today, which called him someone who started out knowing only a former white-collar convict in the business world, the most connected millennial. How did he end up in that publication? By being friends with the writer. I didn't actually know that he was a writer before that publication, as we were building a friendship, he stresses. There are a few things to point out from that experience. One is, don't just meet people because there's a transaction that they could offer you. Build real friendships with the right people. Kleinert knew that what mattered more was not who wrote the article, but where it was published. When he was just starting out, I would look to pitch to people who were contributors, that is, freelancers who are not on staff, to different outlets like USA Today or Forbes or Inc. or Entrepreneur, he says. Those people, unlike staff writers and journalists, have other jobs. If you can work with them to craft pieces that are either about you or mention you as an expert, you're doing those contributors a service by helping them make great content that would grow their brands when they get traffic and saving them time in the process. Using knowledge gaps to build reputation. Abby Binder has also been very smart about her career and how she spends her money. Binder runs Abby Windows, an exterior remodeling firm in Milwaukee and Boston. She's been at it for 12 years and is known as one of the good ones. Once they get over their shock that she is, yes, a woman in a male-dominated field, customers love her. She is honest, direct, and fair, and her reputation reflects this. She also began hosting a monthly radio call-in show where people considering remodeling their homes or apartments can ask questions. Those people, in many cases, transform into clients, as do listeners who view her as an authority in the home improvement space because she's on the radio. The secret is, though, anyone can do this. That means you! People assume that these types of opportunities are only for the privileged. Well, people would be wrong. Binder and others like her are simply the ones who have the gusto to go out there and talk to people, make a bold ask, and see what happens. If you want a radio show, you can go out and get one. Guaranteed. The question you have to ask yourself is that the right avenue to meet the people that I care about? If the answer is yes, Great. Get out there, be brazen, and make it happen for yourself. Binder also makes appearances on Mr. Fix-It, another caller-based show on a local station in Milwaukee. One caller had a roofing gable bend and someone uncovered it, and now her attic is getting condensation, she recalls. I knew right away it was a ventilation issue, so we helped out. My goal was to have her call me, and we fixed it. While radio is a great platform, the context, knowledge sharing, and expertise she offers are what enable her to build relationships with new clients and partners. They're attracted to her because she is authentic in her caring, sharing, and expertise. So it's not surprising that while half of her business comes from these shows, the other half comes from referrals. Solidifying reputation by content association. Earlier, we talked about the power of association. You can get equal value from whom your content associates with. The best connectors don't just extrapolate their own thoughts. They also build content engines that attract amazing people who will, in turn, share their thoughts. The best connectors build their own content engines and real estate by doing what they do best: telling other people's stories. For example, Dan Chabelle with his blog interviews, Lewis Howes with his podcasts, Michael Ellsberg with his book, Scott when he did a video show called Founders Forum with Inc. magazine. You are using all of the tools we have taught. For example, credibility through association, giving value, and so forth, and packing it in the form of content. This also enhances your digital footprint, shows you have access, and enables you to build systems to support this machine so you don't do what most folks do when it comes to content, which is to write 3 posts and then quit. The substance that's geared toward the right people, a strong digital footprint, and so on. We don't want to get into the marketing world lingo or thought process, as those aren't the goals we are talking about. It's about creating new real estate that better defines you to the world and attracts the right people to your community. In general, most people make the mistake of thinking that content must be about promoting themselves and their professional interests. But really, the best way to take advantage of writing, whether on your own blog or in a world-renowned publication, is to set yourself up as the expert or thought leader for that thing you really want to be known for. Chapter 17. Yes, you can be a super connector and pay your bills. And then some. If this were a traditional business book, now would be the time when we'd tell you how to profit from your super connectedness. In other words, how to translate everything we've told you into big bucks. But as you've probably gathered by now, this is not a traditional networking book. Like everything else in life, profiting means different things to different people. To some people, it's about financial reward. To others, it might mean time saved. To still others, it's about career success. Profiting could also be a combination of several things. There is no right answer. We all have different needs and goals, and they all change over time. So your definition of profiting might also evolve over time. But here's the thing about connecting. It's not transactional. You can't become a connector with the goal of making a dollar. As Endeavor founder and CEO Linda Rottenberg says, networks work when they are built on trust, give and take, and long-term attitudes. Where they break down is when they get transactional and people think, what can I get out of it for me? When it's just transaction and getting ahead and no one has an ethos of paying it forward, communities break down. David Cohen of Techstars does not believe that individual relationships should come with a financial ROI. But if you want to think of it as a portfolio of relationships that have an ROI, I don't have any objection to that, he says. I have many relationships that I put energy and effort into so that in aggregate, there will be an ROI. But it's not about the individual interaction. It's about the network of interactions viewed as a whole. As Wharton professor Adam Grant says, everyone needs to set up a line of where they give and where they make money. And you have to make sure that others clearly understand the difference. I've seen this in the community of authors, for example, of people saying, "Look, I don't do free speaking engagements, but I do write for free," he says. Or, "I don't do free consulting, but I'll give feedback on a written document sometimes when somebody asks." Just clearly demarcating what you charge for and what you don't is kind of an interesting strategy.